It is 6 p.m. Wednesday and time for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling, and you're going to find it only here on Houston's community station, listener-sponsored KPFT. I am Hank Rubicek, and today, Eric Heen, a member of the So What's Your Story family, will be a co-host along with me. And along with Mary Edgerton and Larry Thompson, we make up the best team in radio. And each week, we place the spotlight on ordinary people with extraordinary stories to tell. You know, we end every show with, remember, even if your story doesn't always end happily, it doesn't mean you can't live happily ever after. After all, sometimes we find ourselves lost and alone in the dilemma of wanting to leave a job. Maybe your spouse hates you, or maybe your in-laws do. Divorce, disease, disability, and of course, there are the other paths. Going back to school at the age of 50, overcoming addiction, meeting the love of your life, loving your dog, overcoming fear, enjoying that perfect meal. Moments frozen in time, every moment a story that changed your life or someone else's. Well, Eric and I have a few to share if we can get fit in here, because today it's all about you, our listeners. Because we want you to give us a call at 713-526-5738 to tell us a story about a moment that changed your life. No more than 5 minutes. No naughty words. You know what those are, but if you have any doubt, don't use them. When you call, our engineer and friend and KPFT veteran, Captain Tom, will ask you for your first name and ask you to hold tight, and we're going to get you on the air as soon as we can. If you have stories that changed your life, we want to hear from you. Regardless of where you are, you can listen on kpft.org. Go to Listen Live HD1 on top of the page. Now, do we have any kind of any listener, Tom? Tom, we got any callers coming in? Let's see if we got one.
He's on there with someone.
Yeah. Tom, we got a caller coming in? Great.
You bet.
Who do we have? We're waiting for a name. This is the most exciting part of it all. Somebody has a name, and we're about to hear it. This is great. Tom, we got a name? Not yet?
Yes,
all right, let's hear from him. Hello. Hello, caller, can you hear me? Can't hear anything, Tom.
We need some audio, Tom.
Hello?
I hear you.
Okay, there. Great. Who is this?
Hank, this is Chester Weems from
Chester,
Oklahoma.
Chester, how are you, my friend? Great to hear from you.
Hey, I'm great. I thought this was a wonderful thing you put out, and I hope you didn't mind an out-of-stater coming in.
Well, you are the first one. Can't think of a better leadoff hitter. Chester, let's hear your story.
Okay, and I am a member of the San Antonio Storyteller, so that's the way that I wound up with this.
All right.
But yes, actually, I do have a story that has two parts that are the decisive moments, or as you described it, things that made a difference in my life. I grew up in western Oklahoma, small town. Grew up on a farm, then we moved to the small town. Not very sophisticated, hadn't made a whole lot of difference since then either, but at that time it was really bad. Went off to college, about 60 miles away, to a state college, and got through that. But in the last year of my college, I had a professor, a lady. She was a kind of a tough lady, but we had to do a class presentation. And I don't remember her name, or I don't remember the name of the class, but I remember she was kind of redheaded, and she was Republican, which was rare in that part of the state at that time. And she was a strong personality. So I was a little intimidated by her. So I go up in front of the class, and I have my notes all on several sheets of paper, and I lay them on the podium, and they slip off the podium, and my presentation goes all over the floor. I am mortified, but I then proceed to just start talking. And you know what? I didn't need those papers after all. And I'm patient and talking about rivers, and I enjoyed the heck out of it. Enough so, I guess, that I must have impressed the professor, because a couple of days later, she contacted me and said, have you considered a graduate work in geography? And I really hadn't, but she said, well, I have a friend who might be able to help us in this situation, and I would like to make an introduction. He's at the University of Oklahoma. Now, I will tell you, I was scared to go to the state college. So go to the biggest university in the state was just terrifying to me, but I did anyway. I went over there, but before I went, she said, I want you to come by my office. I have something I would like for you to take to Dr. Morris. That was the name of the man that I was going to see. Mm-hmm. I did not know at the time who Dr. Morris was. It turns out he was kind of an important fella. He was the chairman of the department. He was the co-chairman of the city planning department. He was a nationally known scholar, had published many, many articles and several books, and he was her friend. But I went by to pick up whatever it was she wanted me to take, and she said, I would like to take, for you to take to Dr. Morris, this plate of cupcakes. And I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to walk into this important man's place, and I'm going to carry a plate of cupcakes. Well, I did that. And what I didn't know was that between the dropping the papers in the front of the room and walking into an important man's office, carrying cupcakes would change my life for the next several years.
My gosh.
Dr. Morris got me an assistantship. I was the math librarian at the University of Oklahoma. Got my master's degree. And he was so powerful that he literally placed his students where he wanted. And people trusted him. And he got me my first job at Louisiana Tech University. I never even interviewed for the job. I got the job, but the chairman of the department called me and said, I'm offering you this job teaching geography at Louisiana Tech.
Man, what cupcakes
can do. So I did that for 4 years, and then I came back to the University of Oklahoma to work on more graduate work.
Wow.
But those were two interconnected moments that were just very important to me in my life, and they have affected a lot of choices since that time. So I hope that meets your criteria, but those were important to me, small moments.
Does. It really does. You know, listen, and I want our listeners to know, criteria, I think we have some, yeah, sure, but we want to hear from you. This is all about community radio. And Chester, that was a great story. It's amazing what cupcakes can do. And I understand why you became a geography major, because you knew where you were going, right? Right? How do you like that?
Right?
I know,
great.
Stupid joke, but what are you going to do? It's 6:15 in the evening. Best I could do. That was great. Okay.
Great
Thank
story.
You. Thank you, Chester, so much.
Appreciate the opportunity. Best of luck to you.
You bet. Talk to you soon. Next person, we've got Dean calling in. Dean, can you hear me?
You, can you hear me?
We sure can, Dean. How are you, my friend?
Awesome. I'm doing great.
Great. Let's hear your story.
My story, I actually have a title for this. It's called Two Matches. But in middle school, you may remember middle school, Hank. Mm-hmm. But in middle school... As was the common thing, my friend and I, Patrick, we joined the Boy Scouts. And so what was unique about, a little bit unique about our experience is that at that time, he and I were on Glasgow Air Force Base, as our dads were in the military. And Glasgow Air Force Base back then was a SAC base. And SAC base is Strategic Air Command, and that's where the B-52 bombers, or some of the B-52 bombers, that were always in the air, coming and going, and we're right in the middle of the Cold War. And so with Boy Scouts, you had an adult who was the leader, and we had some that came and go. But the best one that we had was a Chief Master Sergeant Sampson. And so what's unique about the military is that once you get to that senior enlisted rank, Chief Master Sergeant, your name suddenly just becomes Chief. I think even his wife called him Chief. And so we just called him Chief, and he was on, but he was great because he just knew everybody on the base. What would happen is that he would contact people. There'd be medics that would come in. We even had one camp out. We went down to Fort Peck Dam and spent the weekend down there with a survival trainer, the ones that would be training the pilots in case they had to crash land someplace. So he taught us all these kind of skills about living out in the wild and all that type of thing. So one weekend, Chief Sampson took about a dozen of us, a couple of cars, Daz, and we all drove out because, you see, in northeast Montana, which is where Glasgow Air Force Base was, there are no trees, literally no trees. As a matter of fact, the base had no trees at all, which is why they named all the streets after trees. I lived on Pine Street, Patrick lived on Elm Street, and we caught the bus at the intersection of Spruce and Oak Street. That's how we got back and forth to school. And so the only trees that were around was off base, around kind of the backside of the base. There was Coyote Creek, and as a creek will run through, trees and other kind of growth goes there. And we decided, or Chief Sampson decided, that he needed us to go out and practice our two-match starting a fire skills. So we took those cars, and there's a dirt road that run around the back, and you couldn't get right up to the creek. So we parked, and then we hiked over to the creek and gathered up some kindling wood, and then we hiked back so that we'd be well away from the trees. And we took our packs, and one of the things that Chief Sampson had got us to do was to put together, each one of us, a Be Prepared pack. You know, scouts are always Be Prepared, right? So we had our packs. And so we had our camping shovels in there, and we dug little holes, and we all practiced our lighting a fire with two matches. And so that went on for a couple of hours as everyone kind of practiced, and each one had a turn to get it done. And then we're packing up, and as we're walking back to the cars, someone noticed that there had been a fire that had started. Now, because there's no trees, the ground out there is pretty hard. It's kind of like an old gentleman's head that no longer, as best it can do, it just can't kind of grow any more than little stubby things that they kind of come up there. And so that's all pretty much that the grass was out there. And the way the fire works is that, well, fire will burn something, and then whatever's next to it just gets heated up, and then it bursts into flame. Mm-hmm. So it's not exactly like a rolling water that fire spreads, but there's always wind in that northeast Montana. And that wind was sure fanning that fire, and it started spreading out. So we quick grabbed our camping shovels out of our Be Prepared packs, and we started scooping dirt, which is hard soil out there, trying to put that fire out. Meanwhile, the control tower had seen that there was a fire, and they sent a fire truck on out there to try to put it out, but the fire truck couldn't go past the dirt road just because the land and the ground was too rough. So they're out there with their shovels and all. Now, while we were doing that, unbeknownst to us, Chief Sampson had got on the radio that was in the fire truck. And then it was a little while later. We didn't really know how much time had passed. But all of a sudden, Chief Sampson starts yelling and says, get down, everybody lay down on the ground. And we looked off, and then we could see that here comes a B-52 plane, and it was coming down lower and lower and lower. Now, a B-52 plane is a massive, massive airplane. It's got 8 jet engines on it, pairs of twos on each wing. So there's a total of 8 engines, and that thing will roar in the middle of the night when they're landing or doing testing on that thing. And so we could see this plane coming in, and maybe a couple of hundred feet off the ground, I'm not sure. But anyway, we're all laying down on the ground, and as it passes over us, and just as it passes the fire, that airplane now points up to about 45 degrees, and that pilot put the pedal to the metal. Well, it doesn't exactly pedal to a metal in an airplane, but I think you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah.
And all of a sudden, those jet engines roared to life, and they blew that fire out like it would be a leaf blower blowing out candles on a birthday cake. Well, we thought that was pretty impressive, but see, my friend Patrick, he, as soon as he saw that airplane coming, he knew what was going to happen, and he got out of his Be Prepared pack a poncho, and he put that poncho on. As soon as that airplane passed, he stood up and grabbed the sides of that poncho, and as soon as that blast of backwash came over, why, it just filled up that poncho, and he shot up into the air like a helium balloon that you let the string go. And then it just sort of settled back down as that airplane moved on. Well, we were just overcome with that. Was so great, Patrick, and we're all gathered around in front of him, and he's, you know, taking it on, and we're just yelling, that was so great, that was so great. And then all of a sudden, his face turns white. His eyes get real big, and we look over our shoulders, and here comes Chief. And Chief is coming on with his legs a-pumping and his arms a-pumping, and if he had a smokestack, why, there would have been billows of smoke coming out of his head. And he walked right up to that kid, and boy, he just let him have it. And all he could say, because you can't tell seventh graders a whole lot of stuff, is all he could say was, "Boogers, boy!"
That's great.
I love it.
I love that. Yeah. Eric's got a couple of comments. That was a fabulous story. Just wanted everybody to know, 713-526-5738. Moments that changed your life. Moments frozen in time. And when you tell your story, it's apparently ready to thaw. I am Hank Rubenchek.
Eric Hank, Keen. Can you still hear me?
Yeah, yeah. Dean.
Hank,
Dean, did you say...
Well, I just wanted to say...
The B-52...
I just wanted to...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to say, what changed my life is that it gets really cold in Montana. That's why I live in Texas.
Ah.
And that's one of the reasons why Eric wants to talk to you. Eric, why don't you let Dean know where you're from?
Well, Dean, I was born and raised in eastern Montana.
You're the only two who live in the state.
Ah, okay. Well, you may
pretty
well
much,
know
the
where
only
Glasgow,
two.
You may know where Glasgow is and Fort
Oh,
Montana.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
When people hear Montana, they think mountains and rivers, but we know the eastern part is nothing like that. It's like living on Mars.
Right.
All right. Great story, Dean. Appreciate
Beautiful.
That.
All right. Thank you very much.
Pine, elm, spruce, and oak, and not a tree in sight. I love it. Okay, great.
Well, I think we got Ellie's on the line with a story.
Right.
Ellie, are you there? Ellie, can you hear me? Ellie? I'm not sure, Ellie's. Maybe she took a coffee break.
Okay.
Can we
go? Let's go to John and then come back to Ellie. How's that?
John. We got John on the line with a story. John, are you there?
Yeah, this is John. Can you hear me?
Hey, John. Yeah, I hear you good. What's your story?
All right. I share this with construction workers a lot.
Uh-huh.
So at 15, I find myself living in the country. My dad makes the bold decision to uproot our family from the unsettling suburbs. Dad grown up on a horse ranch, and he yearns for his seven sons to experience lessons of responsibility and hard work that only the country living could offer. I was not excited about leaving our old neighborhood, and the thought of donning a cowboy hat and boots to school and wearing them to school seemed unappealing to me. But I couldn't bear the idea of my fellow students at Live Oak High School, most who lived in town, to discover my secret life on the farm where I milked a cow each morning. So one fateful morning, as the clock struck 4:30 a.m., there's a piercing beep, 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 jolted me out of my sleep. And then just a few minutes, I muttered to myself and hit the snooze button. 9 minutes later, beep, 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 that tone interrupts my sleep again. Frustrated, I yank the alarm clock cord out of the wall and return back to sleep. At 6:29, I wake up in a panic. I realize, oh no, I need to be at the bus stop right now. So I hastily throw on my clothes, I grab my school bag, and I sprint to the corner, barely making it in time to catch the school bus. Ah, but with a pang of guilt gnawing at me because I had neglected my farm chores. So later, after I already got to school, back at the farm, my mother is abruptly wakened by a bellowing sound. It is the cry of Squeedy Pie, our dairy cow. In a house full of males, my mom has a special bond with Squeedy Pie, another female on the farm. And to her dismay, my mother discovers that I've neglected to milk the cow this morning. Squeedy Pie is crying out in great discomfort, clearly in utter pain. So in a flurry of urgency, my mom dashes to school, and standing in the doorway of my first classroom, she turns to my teacher, excuse me, Judy, and with a pointed finger, she raises her voice, John, you come home now. Sweetie Pie is bellowing because you left home without milking the cow. And as my fellow high schoolers witness this unexpected spectacle, they are stunned. But their shock quickly turns into giggles. And then soon escalates into ruckus laughter. Then, overwhelmed with shame, I lower my head and just reluctantly exit the classroom. So weeks later, echoes of this embarrassing incident still reverberate through the school hallways. Students taunt me, John, did you milk the cow this morning? So a school year drawn to a close, the defining moment arrived. It's time the students cast their votes. The most likely to succeed, the cutest couple. And to my dismay, the experience is chosen as the most embarrassing moment.
Oh, wow. What a great story, John. What a great story.
Sweetie Pie.
Yeah, man, that is beautiful. You are one great storyteller. That is fantastic.
I bet you didn't forget to milk Sweetie Pie again after that.
No
now,
way.
I'll tell you, when I tell this to construction workers, mm-hmm. to tell them don't be rushed, it sticks in their mind, and they literally talk about it for months.
Wow. Mm-hmm. What a great story.
And they tell each other, hey, don't rush out the door and forget to milk Sweetie Pie. That's a big joke we have.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you, John. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, John.
I want to get back and see Ellie. Are you on the line? Ellie? Ellie, are you there? No, we'll try back. We'll try again. Steve, are you there? How about Steve? These are great stories, everybody. 713-526-5738 to tell us about the moment that changed your life. Steve, do you hear us?
I hear you.
Great. What's your story?
Okay. Calling from Dallas. Some time back, a friend and I were reminiscing about our youngest days and some of our fun times and proudest moments, but some were not so proud. And I thought about some of my regrets, and I call this story Mrs. Stubbins. My eighth grade homeroom and history teacher, Mrs. Stubbins, was old and had taught many of the parents and my classmates. We all feared her, disrespected her. She was old enough to retire, so why didn't she? As the school year progressed, we eighth graders somehow coalesced around the idea that we could make her retire, and then we could refuse to learn. And that's what we did. Mm-hmm. One day, as the end of school year approached, the whisper campaign began in the hallways. At an agreed upon time, everybody in the class would do something. Drop a pencil, yawn, cough, moan. Each class had a different plan. We had her for sixth period, the last of the day. We decided on a grand finale. At exactly 3:45 p.m., we would drop our textbooks on the floor, one after another. We could tell that Mrs. Stubbins had had a very trying day. As we neared the end of the hour, nobody was paying much attention to her lecture because all eyes were on the clock. She was in the middle of a sentence when suddenly, boom, a textbook hit the floor. A moment later, boom, another from a different part of the room. And then, boom, 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 a dozen books hit the floor, the sound echoing around the room. I all too gleefully pushed my book over the edge of my desk. And then we waited. Mrs. Stubbins looked shaken, but not surprised. She stood stiffly, took a deep breath, and said, "Take out a pencil, paper, number it 1 through 10. Somehow she came up with 10 questions. I didn't know the answer to most of them, but it didn't matter. The bell rang, class dismissed. She didn't even collect the papers. She'd had one hell of a day. A month later, we assembled in the auditorium for the final day of school. People made speeches, awards were given, and we were about to be ushered out of eighth grade and on to high school. The final reward was given to our most honored educator, Mrs. Stubbins, who'd been teaching school for some 40 years. Several of my classmates booed. I did too. We snickered. Our principal looked stern, and Mrs. Stubbins looked simultaneously sad, yet relieved that it was finally over. Years later, I wonder, why did we do that to the poor woman? If I were to do it over, I would not have pushed my book over the edge, and I'd not have pushed Mrs. Stubbins over the edge. I would have done none of those things. I might even have thanked her and wished her a happy retirement. I could have. I should have. But I didn't.
Wow. Thank you, Steve. Wow.
Thanks, Steve.
Yeah. That is a great, great story. You know, Steve got me, all of you have been thinking a little bit that over the years, we've had some incredible stories, well over 600 tellers here on So What's Your Story. For example, Nikki Cazares, who was the attorney for Anthony Graves years ago, got on a Thursday show and told Anthony Graves that he was going to be exonerated from death row that Monday morning. I remember a mother who told me, you know, Hank, I've got a story that I really want to tell, and I hope it's okay. And, of course, I encouraged her. And she said, I want to talk about the murder of my daughter. And my jaw just dropped. But, you know, we've had so many stories like that over the years. Eric is going to give a little ID here, and we're going to do a little announcements and get back to these great stories. Eric?
This is Eric Keene and Hank Rubicek, and you are listening to So What's Your Story, only on Houston's community station, KPFT, 90.1 FM, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 for our friends in Huntsville. Well, not only does everyone have a story to tell, but Houston is one of the best places to learn how to tell them and well. Let's start with our proud sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, a terrific place to tell stories and meet the nicest, most supportive people around. They meet virtually on the fourth Tuesday of the month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. So visit our website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for the Zoom link to all the story swaps and for information about upcoming events. The Tejas Storytelling Association might be the best storytelling association in the country, and it's a place to enjoy the kind of programs to fill every story lover's dream. And the National Storytelling Network taps into storytellers not only around the country, but around the world.
Thank you, my friend. You know, back in town, our friends at The Moth and Warehouse Live, which is on the second Tuesday of the month, you're going to enjoy some terrific narratives on focus themes that meet a surprise and also meet a surprising number of like-minded storytellers around. But The Moth is a great place to enjoy some real powerful personal narratives. And of course, right here on So What's Your Story, a Houston original and a model in community radio. Please visit us on So What's Your Story at Facebook.com. So What's Your Story? And let us know if you've got any guests that you would like us to consider. And that includes you. Or text me, Hank, at 832-277-1581 with the initials SWYS, of What's Your Story, so I know that it's you and you've got a guest suggestion. We have all that stuff on our Facebook page as well.
Hey, Dr. Hank, I think we got an old friend on the line here. Lauren Neme. Lauren, are you there?
I'm here.
All right. Good to hear your voice again.
Yeah. Yeah, although it's interesting, I've been able to hear you guys, but none of the stories that have been told. So
actually, Lauren, I'm glad you're saying that. It's hard to do that with radios on, but I want everybody to know that this show will be on the KPFT archives, literally about an hour after the program is completed, and it will also be on the Houston Storytellers website forever. So in the morning, if you go to the Houston Storytellers website and you just go to So What's Your Story, you'll see it on the menu, you'll be able to hear you forever. And so will your grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and God knows who else. So not to worry.
Okay. All right. All right. So let me launch into this story. Summer of 1969, I'm at the University of Minnesota taking classes, and I'm also driving taxi. Usually I'm driving taxi from midnight until 9 in the morning. It's a real interesting time to be driving taxi. You get the bar rush, you get the post-bar rush, you get the people who are sneaking around, you get the people who are going to work early, before the suits arrive, before the ties arrive. And, you know, but one day, I have been asked by this guy who I also worked with if I would do a day shift. And I said, well, it's not my usual forte, but I will. And so I got in the cab, 9 in the morning, went downtown Minneapolis, went to the Radisson Hotel, which is one of the big hotels downtown, a good place to pick up people headed to the airport. And this guy who looked kind of like a businessman but didn't have a suitcase flagged me down, got in the cab. I said, where are you going to? He says, I need to go down to the Walker Arts Center. And I went, oh, okay, fine. That was surprising. And we leave the Radisson, we get to Hennepin Avenue, we make the left turn, I start heading toward the Walker, and I don't get but a block, and we're at the next stoplight, when I look in the rearview mirror, and I see he's got a gun pointed at my head.
Wow.
Now, it may have been a small gun, but let me tell you, in that rearview mirror, it was enormous. And it was so big I could count the bullets in the chamber. And I said, what is this? And he said, give me your money. I said, you know, I just started. He said, give me your money. And I said, okay, fine. And I reached down and I gave him the bag that had the $20 worth of starter change in for the day.
Yikes.
And he said, put your head down on the wheel. And I did. And I got to tell you, that moment my head was on the steering wheel, I was thinking many things, including, why the hell am I doing this job?
Wow.
Where I live. You know, what do I do if he shoots me? What do I do if he doesn't shoot me?
Yeah.
And the next thing I hear is the sound of the door opening and closing. And I look and I see this guy running away down Hennepin Avenue, you know, headed a different direction. I call the dispatcher, and the dispatcher sometimes is the great friend and often is the great director of where you should be and when you should be, and I say, I've just been robbed. And he says, stand in line. You're not the only fool here this morning.
Wow.
What a culture. Right. Culture of robbery. Man, oh, man. Yeah, that is, wow, that is startling. That is so startling. You know, many, many years ago, I'm not going to tell the whole story, but many years ago, I worked as a negotiator with the Washington, D.C. Police Department, and I never thought I'd ever go to a scene. I figured, what do I know? I'm an academic, right? I can't do anything. So in any event, I'm at a scene, and I'm told I've got to take it. And I remember asking the cop, what do you mean I got to take it? He says, well, you know, your advisor can't make it. It's an emergency. You're going to have to take this. And all I know is that I had to walk toward this little shabby shack where, you know, the crook was in there with four people on the floor, hostages. And all I thought about was, what will it feel like if I'm shot? And I don't know. It just came to my mind. So when you said, you know, I just don't want to be shot. What it'll feel like when it'll be shot. How would it feel? I mean, that is, in my mind, one of the most frightening images that anybody could ever conjure up. Man, that is some story. Thank you.
I had a gun pulled on me once in my life.
Right.
And I tell you, it's not like it is in the movies. It's not like Clint Eastwood wrestles the gun.
Right.
John Wayne will slap the gun. It's not like that in real life.
No. Yeah.
You run when you see that.
Man, that is frightening. Thank you, Warren. Very cool.
All right.
Oh, thanks, Warren.
Wow. Tracy, can you hear us?
Hello.
Hi, Tracy. Hey. How are you?
Good. How are you?
We are doing great. We are doing great. Have you got a wonderful story for us?
I do. I have a story.
Great.
Okay. Just start whenever I want? Okay.
Absolutely.
Go for it.
I'm walking into the student health services at my university because I had finally decided to deal with how lousy I had been feeling. For months, I had been in denial, telling myself that I was just overworked or overtired, but it was much more than that. I had withdrawn from all my friends, and I hardly ever left my apartment except very late at night because I didn't want to run into anybody. I really wasn't going to class anymore. And I slept all day, and I was up all night. And so I knew that I was depressed. I was going to school at this huge open urban campus, and it was the school I wanted to go to. But from when I got there, I found the place really unfriendly and unhelpful. My advisor didn't even know my name and very rarely had any advice for me. And I went to school in the 90s in the analog era. So if you had to fill out a form or an application, you actually had to go to an office and fill out in pen and drop it off at a different office. And at my school, no matter what office you were in, you were always in the wrong place. And no matter where they told you to go, you were always still in the wrong place. And so you could just watch kids crisscrossing the campus with pamphlets and folders and envelopes just desperately looking for the right place to go. We were drowning in bureaucracy.
Wow.
And so I had been thinking about transferring out. But before I did anything permanent, I decided to go to the infirmary to see if they could help me. Maybe they could refer me to like a therapist, or maybe they could give me medication or something. We had these services available to us. So I walk into student health services, and I walk up to the desk, and the woman says, "Welcome to student health services. How can I help you?" And I said, "I'm here to see the doctor." And she asked me my name and my student ID number, and I gave it to her. And she pointed to a paper book in front of her where my name would have been, and she said, "You don't have an appointment, do you?" And I said, "No, I don't." She said, "You need an appointment first." And I said, "Can I make one now?" She said, "You need to call to make an appointment." And she pointed me through a completely empty waiting room towards a little phone booth, and she said, "You have to go to that phone, call the number on the phone, and make an appointment." And I thought, well, this is some of that bureaucracy that I'm very familiar with. Mm-hmm. So I picked up my book bag, and I put it on my shoulder, and I trudged over to the phone, and I called the number on the phone, and it rang in stereo because it was in the receiver in my ear and at the desk that I just walked away from. And the woman who just sent me away picked up the phone and said, "Student Health Services, how can I help you?" And I said, "I'd like to make an appointment to see the doctor, please." And she said, "When would you like to come in?" And I said, "As soon as possible." And she said, "How about next Monday?" And I said, "Okay, next Monday. Do you have anything sooner?" And she said, "How about now? You can come now. Can you come now?" I said, "Yes, I can come now." And she asked me for my name and my student ID number, and I gave it to her. I hung up the phone. I picked up my book bag. I walked back over to the desk. That same woman greeted me with fresh eyes, as if she'd never seen me before. And she said, "Welcome to Student Health Services. How can I help you?" And I said, "I am here to see the doctor." And she said, "Do you have an appointment?" And I said, "Yes, I do." And she asked me my name and my student ID number, and I gave them to her. And she smiled and pointed in the book, and she said, "Here you are." I said, yep, there I am. And she said, "It'll just be a couple of minutes. You can have a seat." And she pointed to the completely empty waiting room. I put my book bag back on my shoulder, and I went to go sit in the waiting room. And just before I turned around, she gave me a little tiny smile, and she said, "Now, was that so hard?" My eyes got wide.
Wow.
I dropped my book bag on the floor. And I said, "You know, I don't think all of that was necessary."
Wow.
And I picked my book bag and I walked out. And after that, I transferred out of that school.
Wow.
Yeah,
I've been a professor for 42 years at an urban university. So I relate to that a lot more than you might imagine, unfortunately.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, what an incredible story. What an incredible story. really appreciate you sharing that. That was a tough one, and it's so revealing.
Thank you so much. Thank you for giving me the space.
Oh, absolutely.
I appreciate it.
Kidding. Thank you.
Thank you, Tracy.
So much.
Thank you so much.
713.
Have a good night.
You too. 713-526-5738 for stories about moments that changed your life. Eric, who do we have up here next?
Looks like we got Michael.
Michael.
Michael, are you there? Can you hear us?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
We sure can. You got a story for us?
Yes, I have a story for you.
Sounds like you got some trepidation. Sounds like you had a story and you're thinking twice.
Sounds like he can't wait to tell the story. Let's hear it, Mike.
Nah, I have a great story.
We bet.
It's a personal story, and it's a story about me, since it's personal.
Okay.
When I was in high school, I was what they call a runt. I was a little bitty guy. When I was a sophomore in high school, I was 4 foot, 10.5 inches tall, and weighed a whopping 81.5 pounds.
Wow.
And when you're that small, you gotta have a really
it's like you're from Oz
attitude.
Or something. Wow.
I was just a small guy. I was one of those little munchkin guys.
Yeah.
But my father always made a point to make sure that I didn't ever get a chance to use my size as an excuse not to participate in sports or not to fight back with others. So I was always involved in sports. As a matter of fact, in my sophomore year of high school, even at that size, I played on the junior varsity football team.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't a starter, but every now and then, especially with my father on the sideline hollering at the coach, every now and then when the game got into the late quarters, I might get a chance to play a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And they put me in the backfield, and I'd have to block. And, of course, I wasn't as big as those guys, so I didn't do a great job of blocking. But what I could always do is I could go low. A lot of times they would just stumble and trip right over me. That was the advantage of being a small guy. Well, when football season was over my sophomore year, I went out for the basketball team.
Hmm.
And when we had tryouts, I did pretty good. Matter of fact, coach came to me and told me that I had made the team. But that same guy who had been my coach playing junior varsity football, he was the junior varsity basketball coach. And maybe he had been tired of hearing my father fuss about put the kid in, let the kid play. But he made a point to tell me that even though I had made the team, being 4 foot 10.5 inches tall, I was very likely to see any time at all. I probably wouldn't get a chance to play much. He pretty much told me I should go do something different. Well, when I wouldn't complain to my father, he decided that this time he wasn't going to go to bat for me and told me, well, maybe I needed to find something that was more suitable for me. You know, something where I could handle guys my own size,
mm-hmm.
in wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I had never been into wrestling, and the only wrestling I knew was that stuff that they do on TV when they jump off the top rope and they throw each other around, and that just wasn't
right,
for me.
Right.
But it turned out that that wasn't what wrestling was. You know, really, wrestling is a great sport. It's sort of like ballet when you do it right.
Mm-hmm.
But even for me at 81 pounds, I was always still at least 10 pounds lighter than the smallest guy that I ever have to wrestle. So it was always a challenge. I can remember my first match. And matter of fact, the scenario didn't change too much for the second or the third or the fourth or the fifth match. But I remember go out there and I would be trying my darndest. And the guy would flip me over, and I'd be on my back, and the pretty little cheerleaders would be saying, get up, get up, get up. And I'd be looking up at the lights saying, you know, if I could get up, I darn sure would. It would be so painful. And I was so emotional about it that whenever I would lose, well, I would immediately just go sit on the bench and cry.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you know anything about wrestling, there's 12 guys on a wrestling team, and the smallest guy goes first. And with me being the smallest guy, that meant our team was always starting off in a losing position because I was always losing.
Yeah.
That first year, I lost every single match. Every single match. And I would cry after every loss. I was so bad that my family quit coming to see me wrestle.
Oh, that hurt.
You know? But my second year, we had a coach, Coach Delgado, and the Coach Delgado was just an assistant coach, but he was a little guy too. And I didn't know it then, but it turns out that he had been an Olympic champion and been NCAA champion. He had had a heck of a career wrestling. But what was really impressive to me was that he was a little guy. And he would always wrestle everybody on the team, even the big guys, and he would win. And I learned from him that, you know, if I would take this a little bit more seriously, maybe I could get better. So even though that first year I had those terrible days when they announced on the PA system that the wrestling team was very successful last night. They beat the opposing team. The winners wore and the losers wore. And my name would always come up as being one of the losers. It was just that kind of a thing. But that second year, from listening to Coach Delgado, I learned that if I would do the hard work, if I would practice, if I would learn the moves, maybe I can win. And that second year, I ended up winning half of my matches and losing half of my matches, getting better. By my third year, my senior year, I made it to the state championship, and I won. Woo. I ended up getting an athletic scholarship, a wrestling scholarship to go to college.
Wow.
Something I never would have imagined happened. Now, of course, by then, I had grown a little bit. But even with that wrestling scholarship by college, I was still the smallest thing out there. But what I learned is that being small wasn't necessarily a disability. It wasn't a hindrance. It didn't have to stop me. It's like they say, it's the size of the heart in that dog, not, you know, the size of the fight in the dog, not the you know, the size of the dog that matters. And I learned that being small, it was to my advantage. And it made me work harder. And it turned out to be my superpower, I think.
Wow.
And you know what?
Yeah.
As soon as I got used to being a little bitty guy and a little small guy and learning how to deal with that size, I grew a foot in college. 12 inches. But I still hold on to those lessons that I learned from being so small and being a wrestler who went from being totally never winless to being a state champ.
Wow. I got to tell you something. You are, you know, you're an example of the kind of person who tells stories that really allow listeners through windows of their souls. That was a great story, man. Mm-hmm. You really do stretch the boundaries of the human heart. That was great. We're gonna try to get another story in here, another 5-minute story, and we've got Andy. Andy, can you hear us?
Andy, are you there?
Yes.
Great.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah. If you got a 5-minute story for us, we want to hear it.
All right, I do.
Go.
Well, I just go?
Just
go for it.
It's your floor.
Okay. In the summer of 2019, I was planning to take a short trip with my family. We looked at several fun options, such as beaches in Mexico, Keys in Florida, maybe one of the Caribbean islands. But these plans were falling into disarray when I had to make an unexpected and unavoidable work trip to Louisiana. I decided to do my best to roll with it and combine my business trip with my family trip, and I booked a hotel in Baton Rouge. I remember mentioning my trip to one of my work colleagues, and he said, "You're crazy. Don't take your family to Baton Rouge. I'm from Louisiana, and I can tell you it will suck, and your family will not be happy with you." I kept that feedback to myself, and I took them anyway. In the end, we greatly enjoyed the trip. Our hotel was basic, but it was clean and had a fantastic pool that my daughters liked to play in with other kids. Some of the highlights of our stay in Baton Rouge were seeing Mike the LSU Tiger. If you don't know, that's Mike number 7. Eating at Raising Cane's number 1, playing mini golf, and going to have fun on the roller coaster park. The kids loved it. And as with every trip I've had to Louisiana, the food everywhere was incredible. Mm-hmm. On our last full day in Baton Rouge, we were driving near downtown and we saw a hand-painted sign that said African American History Museum. In our laid-back, relaxed tourist on vacation mode, we decided just to check it out. Why not? And that led to a truly memorable experience, one that would end up changing my life. We pulled into a gravel car park and we saw an old house, somewhat disheveled and run down on the outside. The car park was empty and the place looked to be closed. Unfortunately, a sign on the door said the museum was closed that day, and as we were about to drive away, a small woman opened the door of the museum and she waved at us. She told us the museum was closed, but we could come back tomorrow. When we told her we were heading back to Houston the next morning, after a short pause, she opened the door and she said she'd give us a private tour. That lady was a 75-year-old woman named Sadie Roberts Joseph, and she was actually the founder of the museum. So over the next few hours, she shared with us a museum that she loved with unforgettable passion and energy. My wife is a proud Nigerian, and she loved talking with Miss Roberts Joseph about Africa and explaining Nigerian culture. Miss Roberts Joseph had visited neighboring Ghana and had a huge impression on her. My daughters at the time were 8 and 10, and since they're half African, they really enjoyed learning about African-American history. And Miss Roberts Joseph was very patient and caring with them as she shared information. And my girls got to dress up with African clothing, and they played drums and danced to African music. We had an exclusive tour from a passionate museum founder, and it was truly a memorable experience. Miss Joseph Roberts treated us so well, we really hit it off, and we felt like we'd made a new family friend. The next day, we came back to Houston, and I immediately called my work colleague who had recommended we avoid Baton Rouge, and I told him what a great time we'd had. I told him all the places we'd been to, and I especially told him about the African American History Museum and the great time we'd had there. The next day, he called me, and I knew something was up by the way it was the tone of his voice. He told me to go and check the news. That wonderful, kind, and generous woman we'd met, Sadie Roberts Joseph, had been found murdered and left in the trunk of her own car.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God.
My family did not know her well, but hearing about her murder so soon after spending such a wonderful time with her was truly shocking.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Over the next few weeks, a tenant from a rental property she owned was arrested for the murder. She had gone to see him about an overdue rent payment. He was eventually found guilty of second-degree murder and got a life sentence. But the prosecution had a case for first-degree murder, and that carried the death penalty. But I found out that Miss Robert Joseph's family, had asked for the chain charges to be reduced to second-degree murder because they strongly felt that she would never have wanted anyone to die, even for her own murder. Meeting her was unforgettable, and it really did change my life. It helped me see that passion is contagious. It made me realize that the life we're living is fleeting. We can be here today and gone tomorrow. It also reminded me that life is not always fair and that people do not always get what they deserve. Meeting Miss Roberts Josephs demonstrated to me that the legacy we leave behind will be based on how we live our lives and how we interact with others.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt. I was going to tell you that the lessons that you learn are so clear as the story unfolds. You know what I'm saying? In other words, there's no reason to even tell us what this story means because it's so obvious. It's so clear as it unfolds. Yeah. It was so beautifully told. Listen, I want to make it clear we can't take any more stories tonight, but I want those of you who did not have a chance to please do the following. I want you to text me at 832-277-1581. Tell me who you are. The next time we do this, I'm going to get you on for sure. Okay? Trust me on this. Just give me a call at 832-277-1581. Text me. Tell me that you did not have a chance tonight, and we're going to get you on next time. In the meantime, Eric, what are some thoughts that you have about tonight?
Oh, these impactful stories. That last one really got to me. Yeah. I mean, it sounded like a positive stories, and wham, that, oh.
Right.
And just these are the kind of stories that just make you back up and think about life.
Yeah,
they're all good.
The stories do help us make sense of our lives. Our stories validate us. They connect us. Let me ask you a quick question. Can you think of a story, Eric, that made you ever say, I can't believe he or she went through that? Obviously, all of them tonight prompted it, but is there one that you can think of that ever made you say that?
So one thing that our refugee guests that we've had on before, what they've been through, the stories they have. If you go back and hear their stories, what they go through, it just puts your life in a whole different perspective.
Yeah. Refugees. Wow. Amazing. Thank you, everybody, tonight for this incredible show. We're going to be doing this again. This is really an icon in community radio. At least that's what we think it is, this show, So What's Your Story? And we just want you to know that it's because of you that this show has been successful since 2008. We want you to tune in every week and listen to everything that you guys have to say. We're going to have some great guests coming up, and we're going to certainly be doing this again. Thank you, Eric, for hosting with me today, and to Captain Tom for fielding calls, working the boards. My God, he worked hard. We got to increase his pay at this volunteer position, right? Thank you to all of you, our listeners, who really do know the power of story. We don't want anybody to move because Michael Woodson and Michael Carson are up next with Living Art, which is another KPFT exclusive. In the meantime, we want to make Houston...
Let's make Houston Community Station, KPFT 90.1 FM, a part of your everyday life. Be sure to join us every Wednesday at 6 p.m. for So What's Your Story? You keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Eric Heen and Hank Rubicek, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we want you to always remember that it's never too late to live happily ever after.
Peace.
Peace.
This is 90.1 KPFT FM and FM HD1 in Houston.